The first reading this morning comes from Karen Armstrong's latest book, 12 Steps to a More Compassionate Life, published just last month. Karen Armstrong, a former Catholic nun who now teaches at both Jewish and Muslim academies, describes herself as an agnostic.
There is much talk about the need for dialogue as a way of improving international relations. But are we prepared to make a place for the other, or are we determined simply to impose our own will? An essential part of the dialogue must be the effort to listen. We have to make a serious effort to hear one another's narratives. All too often, when enemies start to tell their story, the other side interrupts, shouts them down, objects, and denounces it as false and inaccurate. But a story often reflects the inner meaning of an event rather than factual historical accuracy. As any psychoanalyst knows, stories of pain, betrayal, and atrocity give expression to the emotional dimension of an episode, which is just as important to the speaker as what actually happened. We need to listen to the undercurrent of pain in our enemy's story. And we should be aware that our version of the same event is also likely to be a reflection upon our own situation and suffering, rather than a dispassionate and wholly factual account.
The second reading is a personal testimony from the Pentecostal Christian theologian Miroslav Volf, who now teaches at Yale Divinity School. This comes from the preface to a book by an evangelical Christian pastor named Brian Zond called Unconditional, which is the most remarkable text on the topic of forgiveness that I have ever read. And believe me, I've read them.
I grew up the son of a Croatian Pentecostal minister. After my own brief stint as a prodigal, I was baptized and became a committed Pentecostal. As a young man, I was active, but that began to change when I arrived in California in the fall of 1977 and encountered American Pentecostalism. I stumbled upon over-the-top flamboyant TV evangelists. I was shocked by the strange spectacle. Preachers were peddling a compromised gospel of wealth, wealth and power, which believers had a right to claim as their own as a simple act of faith. That seemed to me a faith designed not to direct people striving toward God and neighbor, but to feed the whole of their self-absorption and greed. And then came the war against terror and the obsession with security. After 9/11, America was gripped by the spirit of kick-butt culture. Many Pentecostals, along with many evangelicals, believed the war was really a face-off between Yahweh of the Bible and Allah of the Quran. This was not the Pentecostal faith of the Azusa Street Revival, the first generation of Pentecostals. And this was not the faith I learned from my father. He never prayed that God would shower blessings on the poor, but that we would be generous to them. And he reminded me more than once that Jesus commanded his followers to love their neighbors, including their enemies. In his old age, he insisted that an Albanian Muslim for who he worked when he was young was the best man for whom I ever worked.
Thank you.
I think it's best to start off this morning with the last line of the affirmation that we read together, which I adapted for this service from a poem by Stephen Levine. If anything other than love could do it, I'd have done it already and left the hardest to last. I trembled when I first read that line and realized its wisdom would rightfully challenge me as I worked on the sermon. And Levine's words are a lovely way of saying that wrestling with all of this, the competing ideas associated with the words enemy and love and listening, is tremendously difficult, tremendously hard. Hard for me to express with unmistakable clarity. Hard, I have to imagine, for you and me to hear without necessary and welcomed resistance and our handy list of exceptions. That being said, let's go. When I announce a sermon title in a newsletter, I find it intriguing that I always, always end up hearing or reading one of the key words in that title over and over and over again during the week before I step into the pulpit. This week, I must have heard the word enemy in one form or another at least a dozen times. I heard it while just flipping channels late one night. I passed the talking head Glenn Beck, who called the religion of Islam America's cunning enemy. Moments later, I heard Rachel Maddow on MSNBC use a variant word, frenemy, a fusion of the word friend with the word enemy, which I had never heard before, but friends of mine tell me it's been around for a while. She was talking about certain nations in the Middle East. Later that day, the next day, over at Panera, I heard a teenager use that same word, frenemy, to describe her difficult relationship with one of her cousins. In the middle of the next night, when I couldn't sleep, I turned on the TV again, only to immediately hear Sarah Jessica Parker on her show about dating in New York refer to a former boyfriend as a frenemy. Changing channels, I ran across the great film from the 60s, Man for All Seasons. There sat the glowering Orson Welles playing Cardinal Wolsey in the days of Henry VIII. Wolsey, all dressed in red, has just finished arguing with Sir Thomas More over the issue of obtaining a divorce for King Henry. More refuses to support him. Wolsey then looks at More ruefully and says, "Come down to earth. Until you do, you and I are enemies, Thomas." Enemy. Clearly, the word is just plain difficult. That someone joined the two words friend and enemy to make the word frenemy shows me that very clearly. And remember, in our morning story, our hero calls his new neighbor, Jeremy Ross, his enemy, his best enemy. Why? Because Jeremy laughed at him when he struck out at bat. And Jeremy didn't invite him to a party. There, the word enemy seems pretty shallow. Since these things are, in the scheme of things, I think you would probably agree, rather petty offenses. Yet the boy's father seems to know this when he offers to bake a pie to rectify the situation, an enemy pie, as he calls it. But, says the father, there is one part of enemy pie I can't do. And then he says to his son, in order for it to work, you need to spend a whole day with your enemy. Are you sure you want to do this? And of course, the son nods and says yes. But wouldn't you know it? By getting to know this enemy he doesn't like, he gains a new and very good friend. Now, this approach to the word enemy reminds me of Abraham Lincoln, whose birthday we celebrate this month, and who once said of a man he knew, "I don't like that man. I must get to know him better." In fact, President Lincoln was famous for trying to turn enemies into friends, going so far as to put some of them onto his cabinet. And he and Stephen Douglas, in their very famous Illinois debates, came across as rancorous, bitter enemies. But in fact, Lincoln and Douglas were very good friends off the playing field of politics. Not just people sitting next to each other across the aisle, as noted at our State of the Union recently, but real friends who actively looked out for the welfare of each other's families. And in a book I am reading with some others in this congregation, I found these autobiographical words by Thomas Merton, the great Trappist monk. There was this shadow, this double, this writer who had followed me into the cloister, into the monastery. He is still on my track. He rides my shoulders. I cannot lose him. He still wears the name of Thomas Merton. Is he my enemy? Of course, Merton ended up becoming well known for his writing over the years, even though that's not the ordinary practice of Trappist monks. It sounds to me as if Merton felt as if he had two opposing selves inside of him, since he identified first with being a monk, not a writer. He thought of his temptation to write as the work of an enemy. But it was only, I think, just another part of himself. But of course, the word enemy doesn't always refer to someone we don't like, or with whom we disagree, or who is our opposite, either out in the world or within our own struggling soul. For example, I may disagree with some historian about a certain point, such as whether the biblical King David was a real king of a young nation, or just, as some archaeologists would have it, a Hebrew version of Robin Hood. But I can't imagine calling someone who simply disagrees with me an enemy. But when the right-wing evangelical pastor I referred to last week in my sermon, the USA preacher Scott Lively, says cruel and absurd things, I wonder if enemy is not indeed the best word to describe him, even though I don't personally know him. For example, Pastor Lively rants, without evidence of any kind, of course, that Adolf Hitler and the entire Gestapo and most of the brutal Nazis were all gay, and that therefore he is right to try and save the nation of Uganda from being taken over by these wildly violent and sick sex fiends. I guess I really have no problem at all with thinking of this man as my enemy. And of course, this is a bit like the bitter enmity that Martin Luther King had to deal with in his life. The words that he heard regularly from lynchers and segregationists all around him were just as absurd, hurtful, twisted, and cruel. King heard words that were so foul that I have to simply admire his fortitude in enduring the enemies who surrounded him each and every day. many of whom he actually knew, unlike me with Scott Lively. Yet, King preached a sermon one day at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church back in 1957 called Loving Your Enemies. He had a terrible cold that day. But still, it was a dynamite sermon. He admitted that for many, Jesus' famous dictum to love your enemies was impractical. And worse, proof, as he said, that just like Sir Thomas More in the movie Man for All Seasons, Jesus needed to come down to earth and stop all this idealism nonsense. Many people who think the word love means to like, or somehow even to excuse, feel the same way. These people are asking me if I could like someone like Scott Lively, or if you could like someone who speaks against you. How can anyone like someone who is opposing you, lashing out at you, ridiculing you, or worse, mocking you for what you stand for, or even for who you are? King, however, insisted in his sermon that Jesus' words are not some sort of oriental exaggeration, but practical. Eminently practical, and an absolute necessity for the survival of our situation. Strong, unequivocal words. Brian Zond and Miroslav Volf seem to agree. As I said, Zond's book is the single strongest case for unconditional forgiveness that I have ever read. It's powerful, and it's centered on the same text that King lifted up. Now, frankly, Pastor Zond and I disagree about many things. He is an evangelical Christian, and I am not. He is against gay marriage, and I am not. He regards the Bible as God's word. I see it as a very human collection of books. We differ in a number of other areas, too. But he is not my enemy. His book is filled with unwavering respect and kindness. No sneaky manipulation. There is no ranting, just a true reaching out for understanding from within his beloved religious tradition. Taking it seriously, not superficially. That is why teaching minister Miroslav Volf, raised in the fastest growing religion in the world, Pentecostalism, and just as a footnote, there's actually a Pentecostal congregation, if you want to call it that, in Korea, that has over 1 million members. I could hardly believe that when I read it and I checked up on it. Anyway, fastest growing religion in the world, Miroslav Volf loved Zond's book as much as I did. He, too, wants to take his religious principles seriously. He, too, thinks that religion is about the care of human beings, not a rollicking circus entertainment. He, too, is disgusted with what happened to the original Pentecostal fervor, radically multiracial and experiential in practice, that erupted historically. This is the origin of Pentecostalism in this country. That erupted on Azusa Street in Los Angeles back in 1906. It all started with a great 5-year-long series of revival services led by a certain Reverend Seymour, an African-American preacher. Volf knows that Pentecostalism and not the modern form of Pentecostalism. He is not at all happy with the American TV examples of Pentecostal fervor, like Benny Hinn, who slaps people with his white coat to heal them in a theatrical frenzy, or the now rampant wealth and prosperity Pentecostalism, invented only a few decades ago by Oral Roberts of Tulsa, and now enriching, and you can underline that word, enriching preachers like Mike Murdoch, Kenneth Copeland, Creflo Dollar, Marilyn Hickey, Morris Cerullo, and our own local Rod Parsley. Wolf and Zond both are not happy with the anti-Muslim, anti-gay rants popular amongst these preachers, and he wonders why anyone would see whole categories of people as enemies in the first place. Wolf remembers his father, who revered his Muslim boss, and the Pentecostalism of his own non-American Croatian roots, which was not about demonizing others or tearing them down, but about enlivening experience and real concern for how we might live out the values of the Sermon on the Mount, including the words, love your enemies. But how do you do that? How do you love your enemies? Does loving them mean trying to see if what they say has any merit? King asked this question too, of course, but King does not advise finding merit in your enemy's ideas if that idea is that you are a worthless pile of manure. King was not a fool. But I think Karen Armstrong translates King's reflection in modern language that transcends any particular religion, since she claims none. Armstrong agrees with Levine that loving one's enemies is the hardest thing it's possible to do. In her book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, she places love of enemies as step 12, the last of the 12 steps. Agreeing literally with Stephen Levine that love is left to last. But she insists that in order to love, there has to be conversation, that is, dialogue. Then she says this, the essential part of the dialogue must be the effort to listen. We have to make a serious effort to hear one another's narratives, that is, stories. All too often, when enemies start to tell their story, the other side interrupts, she writes, shouts them down, objects, and denounces it as false and inaccurate. But, she says, a story often reflects the inner meaning of an event rather than factual historical accuracy. As any psychoanalyst knows, stories of pain, betrayal, and atrocity give expression to the emotional dimension of an episode, which is just as important to the speaker as what actually happened. Just as important. We need to listen to the undercurrent of pain in our enemy's story. And we should also be aware that our own version of the same event is also likely to be a reflection upon our own situation and suffering rather than a dispassionate and wholly factual account. She's just not going to let us off the hook. Wow, this is powerful and difficult stuff. There's no question. I tried to make that clear at the beginning of this sermon, and composing this sermon has only underscored my initial intuition about this theme. But I think what she says is worth wrestling with. Listening, huh? Take the example I offered earlier. If Scott Lively was willing to talk with me and not preach at me, I would try to make an effort to hear his story, the narrative of his life, if he was willing to share it. I would bet everything that I have, that there is some awful tale of violation there in his life. When I hear the vile things that he says, I am hearing echoes of vile things that surely happened in his own life. Inexcusable things. Violent things. I hear tremendous projection on his part. But for years, and some of you have heard me say this, for years I have said over and over again that I simply do not have the power to believe that someone like Lively reads a passage of Scripture, a bunch of ink on a page, and because of that alone, musters up all this cruel preaching and distorted history. I don't have enough faith to believe that anyone reads a text and abracadabra becomes a spiritual maniac. Instead, taking Karen Armstrong seriously, I am hearing him say that his own life has been cruelly distorted by something. I can guess, sure, what some of those things are. I'm not going to do that here. I would rather listen than conjecture. Now, obviously, he and I are not sitting across from each other, and I've already conjectured a lot. But after 37 years of doing this work, I've noted a few patterns. I've heard 1,000 parallel stories. And if I could get the courage, or even, I admit it, the stomach, to talk to this man, and if he was willing to fairly converse instead of preach at me, I would guess that is what I would find. I would still stand against his violent words in Uganda and fight against his cruelty if he continued it. But I would do so, I hope, less from a stance of vengeance and hatred, and a bit more from a vantage of encountering another human being who, like me, and like every one of you, has not passed through this life unwounded. You see, Stephen Levine was right. We can pray, we can read, we can talk, we can contemplate, we can fight all we want as black belts. We can even bake an enemy pie if we have the recipe. But at the very end, just like at the very beginning, we are left with the challenge of love, listening to our enemies to find the deeper answer to the basic religious question, what indeed does it mean to love?